Welcome, this is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com. It's the 4th of October 2011 here in Japan, but still the 3rd of October 2011 in New York, where I'm joined on the line by Brad Morrison, a correspondent of the Corbett Report who has been in attendance of some of the recent Occupy Wall Street rallies. So I'm excited to hear more about that. Brad Morrison, thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us today.
Hey, James, how are you?
Well, I'm doing okay, but I'm more to the point, how are you? So tell us a little bit about yourself and about the protests that are going on right now.
Well, I'm a New York metro area person my whole life, and I've been waiting for things to heat up in New York for a long, long time. I'm a student of what's been going on worldwide with the protests, and when things people decided to occupy New York or occupy Wall Street, my interest was piqued. So this past week I was down in the park and met with people, and then I was part of the march that went to Police Plaza in response to the fact that the earlier march had been broken up by the police fairly violently in a couple cases. And I have to say, I'm old enough to remember, at least as a teenager, the protests during the Vietnam War. And there's a lot of the same feeling, kids, I'll call them kids because they're quite a bit younger than me, in my early 50s. Younger people are really energized and know that something is afoot and that things are changing. And I don't think that what they want, their goals, have started to really be truly enunciated or become focused yet, but they're well on the way to doing that. And the one thing that seems to be the common consensus with everybody that's there is they know that the banks have robbed the country, if not the world, and they want them held accountable.
Well, that does seem to be the ground common consensus. But as you say, I think the real movement is still being shaped at this time, and we're still yet to see what is really going to play out from this. But perhaps first you can walk us through a little bit what the sights and sounds that you saw at the protests were and what the general feeling there was.
Well, it's I would say it's about, 70% people in their 20s. And early 30s, and then a mix of what I've seen at other protests around the country, of people that take up social causes that are a little bit older. Everybody there, there's a good portion of the people that seem to have come to it from the libertarian side with Ron Paul, and there's, I would say, it's a melding of that and people on the liberal side, who have always had a great distrust of corporate America. And there seems to be a general consensus among people that what's afoot now is a kind of fascism, the melding of, you know, corporate and state interests. The police actions early in the early protests, which I didn't attend, but I watched a lot on live feeds. I live about 40 minutes outside the city. This kind of galvanized people to act, and the march on Police Plaza, I would guess, was about 10,000 people, which seems to agree with most of the reports. And I have to say that the police have done their best, and Bloomberg, who of course is a Wall Street crony, have done their best to make it as invisible as possible. For example, they don't allow any amplification. They confiscate bullhorns. The police have been taking cameras from people. They're doing everything in their power to stop people from being able to raise a ruckus. And what's interesting is the immediate reaction is that the crowd turned itself into a bullhorn, where one person would stand up on a podium and speak, and the crowd would repeat everything that this person was saying in unison, so that you had 1,000 voices repeating the message. And there's really nothing that the police can do about this. And I have to say, it was a pretty cacophonous sound, and at times fairly intimidating for the police department in New York, I believe.
Well, that is hopeful in so many ways, that there's always ways to get around the ridiculous rules and regulations that they can put in. And as I understand, even the wearing of the Guy Fawkes masks that Anonymous has taken to in recent years has now been banned in public, unless it's some sort of costume party or some ridiculous regulation like that.
Well, that I think is going to be one of the central issues, the coming social disorder is the right to anonymity one of our natural rights, one of our basic rights? And I would argue that it is. The fact that they are trotting out surveillance on such a worldwide scale, I think if you talk to anybody in the military industrial complex that knows what they're talking about, they would tell you that they have 24-hour satellite surveillance of the whole surface of the planet already. And now they're putting cameras on every street corner. Mayor Bloomberg has pushed very hard for this. If you go to the city of London, the city of London is covered in cameras. And you have to ask yourself, with that combined with facial recognition technology, does the state really have a right to know who is out in public at any given moment? And I would argue that they don't. There's no compelling reason. They don't have any probable cause to know who you are. But they are moving towards that end. And I think the Guy Fawkes masks, which of course are tied to the V for Vendetta film and the graphic novel, and of course the tradition of Guy Fawkes' celebration and troubles in England, I think are a natural reaction to it. And I think that like all social trends, whether it be punk or hippiedom or geekdom in the 60s, or going back even further, they will react to this with the fashion will become being anonymous, being masked. You know, if you step on the people, they will react. And it's a fairly common theme there. And yes, they are being banned. And also Bloomberg has announced publicly that he's going to end this quickly. He's attempting to portray the protest as young people against the middle class, which is really ludicrous, because I would say 20% of the people there are standard middle-aged, middle-class Americans. This is not a battle against the middle class. And then, of course, on Saturday, the police lured the protest out onto the Brooklyn Bridge roadway. It had been scheduled to cross the Brooklyn Bridge, and when the protesters approached the bridge, the police basically waved them onto the roadway. And the protesters thought, oh, they're going to escort us across the bridge. Halfway across the bridge, they run into paddy wagons and barricades and lines of riot police, and they arrested 700 people to take names and make examples of them. And I think it was a deliberate setup.
It certainly seems to be. And as you say, I think the way that various groups are trying to portray these protests and the protesters who are making them up, I think that there's a lot of different agendas going on here, and people are trying to present this in various different ways. But as you say, I think it seems to be a pretty heterogeneous group, and there are lots of different people from lots of different perspectives there. So I think from my perspective, it seems to be more what we can make of these protests, or what we can make them into as educational opportunities, rather than simply accepting whatever people are telling us they are.
I would agree. And it's interesting to note that shortly after it became obvious that the protests were going to start to break in the press, the celebrities started to turn up for their photo ops. You know, Susan Sarandon and Roseanne Barr, to basically show up for 15 minutes and talk to the protesters, get their photo taken, and you know, jet set out of town, which you know, I think can be expected in a scenario like this. But the danger lies that there's really no leadership. That's a strength in a great many ways, especially in the face of the police in New York City, who have been trained to pick out the leaders and to neutralize them. But the message of the protest won't gain strength, I think, until they find some leaders and they find some messages where there's a general consensus on one or two topics. And when they finally get to that point, and I see that coming in the next few weeks, then it's going to start to make an impression. Already, the establishment in New York City is scared, and they are reacting as quickly as they can to try and put it down. I don't think that they ever thought it would start, at least at this time.
Well, I agree with that assessment, and I think there are a lot of people who are very nervous as this movement starts to coalesce into something more concrete and perhaps a final idea that starts to coalesce. But I think that, again, I think it's an opportunity, because if we don't insert our voices into the mix right now, then there is the chance for this to be co-opted or corrupted or shunted off into side issues that don't matter. So I think it's important to try to educate people. But I think maybe we should step back a little bit and think a little bit more deeply about the protest movement in general and really what it indicates. And I understand that you've been doing some research into common law and history of in that general theme. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about some of the research you've done, and really maybe we could start by sort of defining common law and really what it is and where it comes from.
Well, common law is often mistaken. It's you hear it bandied about in speech. People may often mistake what it is. They confuse it for natural law. Natural law, going back through Locke and Hobbes and Grotius, various scholars, some people would argue it goes all the way back to Plato, which I think is a bit suspect. But basically, natural law is the idea that we are born with certain rights, and that the laws that protect these rights can be reasoned out from basic human experience and basic human existence. And a lot of people, I would argue, I agree with them, that the Declaration of Independence is a classic example that embodies natural law, the idea that we are born with inalienable rights. That's natural law. Common law is, in some respects, more concrete. It's basically the history of English law and the cases that have happened throughout English history, and the precedents that they set. And this goes back to Henry II in 1150. He issued instructions to his ministers to basically take a country he had just conquered and unify the laws, which included, I believe, Dane law and the law of Wessex and various traditions, both Anglo-Saxon and other traditions, where law had been decided by common body. And starting then and moving forward, you start to see the beginnings of the jury system and the idea that justice is thing that that the population has a voice in, that justice is something that is easily recognizable to every citizen, to every person that is under the system. And in common law, which is the basic law of the United States, and which is the bottom of the law pyramid, it supersedes statutory law or regulatory law. In other words, law is written by a legislature or a law created by a bureaucrat. The basic idea is that common law says if there's a precedent, that the judges that follow this precedent or judges that rule on a similar issue at a later date have to follow this precedent because it's already been shown to be just. That's the most basic overview of common law. Now, it ends in some ways with the ideas of natural law. Now, you often hear lawyers and talking heads on TV mention common law, and they only talk about it from the idea of case law. But there's a much bigger reading of common law that is recognized by the courts in the United States and in England and most of the places that the English ruled at one point or another, like Sri Lanka or Hong Kong. And that idea is that there is also protection of basic human rights as part of common law, that the judge sitting in judgment of any person has to recognize the fact that this person has inalienable rights, and they have to protect them through due process. And as part of that part of common law, there's this idea that there are some positive duties attached to common law. And this brings up a concept which I've mentioned in emails to you, Pat, in the past, which is in loco parentis, which is Latin for in the shoes of the parent, standing in the place of the parent. And in common law, this is used in a bunch of different applications, but the basic way to view it would be if you saw a child about to do a thoughtless act that would endanger him and you were an adult, the court would hold you responsible to stop the child from doing that. You're standing in the shoes of the parent. An interesting anecdote is that during the Clinton-Lewinsky affair, it often came up in legal arguments because there's a natural indictment that the President of the United States, who has these interns as his employees and in his care, should behave as if a parent, he were a parent in this case, and that would preclude him having any kind of a romantic entanglement with them. There's another reading of in loco parentis, which I think is a blend of common law, natural law, and some other concepts like the concept of quitam, which is the idea that a person can act to prosecute a wrong on behalf of the state. If you're aware that someone is defrauding the government, for example, you can sue quitam and say, I know this is a crime, and I am going to start this process and protect the state from this crime. This is someone, again, this is a blending of this idea of parenting. And there's another common law concept, parens patriae, where the state reverses that and says, well, the state is standing in as the parent. And this is often cited when the state seizes someone's children and says, well, we're standing in as a parent because you're not a good parent. What's interesting about all those concepts is they all are a form of positive duty, where there's a duty that's attached to you as a member of society. And the current protests that we're seeing, in a lot of respects, are the population standing in the shoes of the founding fathers. The people are acting to undo an injustice that they see the system will not correct. And this has a long history in common law. And although it's not always cited as in loco parentis, there are many cases throughout English history and early American history where the right to protest, the right for redress of grievances, which of course is part of the First Amendment, the part that people usually forget after speech and assembly and religion. But this is the idea that the right to petition for redress of grievances, or the right to act on the behalf of what's good for the republic, is a positive duty to the population, and those that take it up are protected by the common law.
Absolutely. Well, some fascinating history and fascinating concepts there, and I think that really, to my mind, brings, of course, the Declaration of Independence and the duty of people to overthrow governments that have become abusive of their populations.
Certainly, it's many people argue that the founding of the country, the creation of the Constitution, and everything that comes from that it's called declarationism. That's a hard one for me to say. And the idea is that the Declaration of Independence is the basic structure that everything else springs from. And of course, the Declaration of Independence embodies the natural law concept of inalienable rights, and also embodies the common law concept to address those grievances against the oppression of those rights. And the preamble as written by Jefferson's a great student of the law, lays it all out and says that it's not something that you can do, it's something that you must do. Interestingly, if you read English law history, Blackstone, who's the great authority, views common law rights as positive rights, the rights that that the court has preserved through all these years, and various courts, various juries have found to be what is just on its face. It's kind of where common sense gets the rule. And if we ever needed a time with common sense, I would say now is the time.
That's true, and I think you definitely make the case that, really we do as citizens have a duty, an obligation at times where there are great abuses, a long train of abuses and usurpations, one might say, going on, and demonstrably so, that it becomes our right and our duty to really to overthrow that and to institute the form of government which will best serve us. But although it does have that sort of I suppose that imperative behind it, it doesn't really, in a declarative sense, tell us what we ought to do, what really need to institute in and of itself. I.e., it's not a prescriptive form of action.
No, I think the basic concept, again, if you go back to the Declaration of Independence, is that those who decide to change a system get to redefine it as what fits them at the time. I believe that Jefferson and the Founding Fathers, when they wrote the Declaration of Independence, had a great trust for any body of people that would be willing to forego their creature comforts, their sense of security, their sense of stability in order to overthrow a system, and that they recognized that anyone who took that action, as they were taking, would have the right to define the society as they saw fit. The unfortunately, in the complacent modern America, people have fallen into this kind of sleepy coma where they believe that the Supreme Court or the courts in general's job is to ensure their rights and to redress grievances. And they have, in a lot of ways, transferred their power through inaction to those bodies. And those bodies are really kept honest by the population. It goes to the same concept of jury nullification, the idea that a jury can look at a given law or given instructions from a judge and say, no, this is not the way it should be. We as a jury have decided that this person is not guilty because that law is absurd. This is often railed against in the press, and the courts at times have tried to stop this. But there's, again, a long, long history of common people sitting on a jury and doing what they believe is just against all objections. This is also preserved in the grand jury system, which is still very active in the United States. And I'm sure the powers that be would love to get rid of grand juries, but they still meet to pass indictments. And in some cases, you know, the common citizen can go to a grand jury and bring criminal indictments against officials. And this is, most people don't realize that they have this power, but this is enshrined in common law. It goes back for the better part of 1,000 years, and they cannot stop someone from filing criminal charges against anyone in official capacity. They are shielded in their official duties for action against them for being an official. But once they cross the line into what can be viewed as criminality or oppression, then they can have criminal charges filed against them. And this is starting to crop up all over the country, especially in really contentious child custody issues that people run into. And you're seeing more and more people represent themselves, go into the court pro se, and stand up and say, I have the right to do this and this and this, and to file criminal charges against the system if the system will not allow them access to the law. Another example of how the common law trumps statutory law.
Well, I think this brings up an important concept and an important distinction that I try to make clear in a lot of my work, is that people tend to think of the law, or we have the received worldview that the legal system itself is really creating the laws, or that the laws come from the legal system. But of course, that's not the case. Of course, the laws are really in the power of the people, that the people create them, the people institute them, whether that's through the form of their representative government writing laws, which are then interpreted by the courts, or whether that's something more like the direct action that we see going on in the Occupy Wall Street. Still, the power really comes from the people, and the courts and all of that is really something secondary, and there to really just enforce what the people really want to have happen.
I think a common view of it. I might split that hair slightly and say that the power of government to create laws, statutory law, is recognized quite clearly by the court system and by the certainly in America by the American justice system, for what it is, which is statutory law. And statutory law has effect and power. It is, in effect, your elected representative embodying the power of the people. But it does not trump common law. You cannot just go and write a law that overturns 1,000 years of common law history. This has been tried out many, many times in history. And very rarely does statutory law completely trump common law. This is one reason why I believe the Second Amendment has never been seriously tried in the upper courts in the United States. Every time they take a Second Amendment case, they find a way to rewrite that case as relating to another common right, like the common right against search and seizure, so that they will not address the Second Amendment as itself, because once they do that, they will in essence overrule all of the statutory law that currently restricts people's access to firearms. There's a famous case in the early Republic, Marbury versus Madison, where they rule that the federal government trumps state law and local law. And this is taught to every law student, and it's commonly accepted. What most people don't realize is the second half of the case basically lays out that that the only time that that federal law trumps all these other laws is when it says this specifically replaces common law, and only in that particular case. And all the other portions of the Bill of Rights have been tested extensively by the courts, but the Second Amendment has been avoided. And by avoiding it, they essentially have given common law people no traction in the courts to challenge the statutes. And when they recently, there was a couple of recent cases where they came very close to ruling straight on the Second Amendment in federal court. And if they ever do that, they will immediately wipe away all of the restrictions on firearm ownership in the United States, because the courts will have to recognize that the common law supersedes statutory law. Statutory laws made up by men, and common law is the law created by the adjudication, the act of judges, and the justice of courts and juries for 1,000 years. And that is considered of a higher hierarchy than statutory law, and certainly regulatory law. So I think there's a misconception nowadays about where written law lies. If you can find in the common law thread to hang a case on, you often have a much stronger argument in court and subsequently on appeal that a statute that was written by, any state legislatures, save Louisiana, which oddly enough is still based upon French and Roman law, you have a much stronger case to say that this statute is unjust and that the court cannot enforce it.
Well, it certainly does beg the question then of what people can do in the face of statutory laws and regulations and acts that are passed that do go fly in the face of established constitutional law and common law. For example, the Patriot Act, which of course has eviscerated the Bill of Rights. Are people simply to abide by them until the courts finally rule that it's unconstitutional, or is there something that people should be doing in the meantime?
Well, certainly, I would encourage people to challenge, to take them on directly. The Patriot Act certainly overturns the Fourth Amendment directly, and trods upon a series of other amendments. And unfortunately, we seem to have courts that have bought into the idea of maintaining the status quo, maintaining the system, not allowing the challenges and letting the powers that be rule unfettered. But the more challenges that are thrown up against this, the more difficult it gets for a court to the courts to protect it and to or to evade ruling on it, which is generally what's done nowadays in modern America. The upper courts, whether it be the Supreme Court of a state or the Supreme Court of the United States or the federal court system, will often find other reasons to issue rulings that meet their needs and to not challenge a statute, in this case, the Patriot Act, directly. And the more cases that are presented against it, the more likely that a court will find itself boxed in. It's very difficult. No judge likes to be appealed successfully. It is a black mark on their record. And when there's case law against them and common law against them, it's very, very difficult for them to maintain that. So they'll often find a different section of the law, a different issue under law, in order to rule. Oddly enough, courts are still governed by law and the lawyers. The lawyers are all in cahoots with the courts. They are part of the system, and none of them want to make waves. It's a rare lawyer that will basically destroy their career and take on a judge. But this is not the case with someone representing themselves going into court pro se. When a person goes into court pro se, they are protected. They have rights, and the court cannot bully them. The court cannot control what they do. The court cannot stop them from filing things, cannot stop them from filing challenges. Cannot, for example, in the state of New York, which has probably the largest body of common law cases of any state in the union, which is why it's used, the laws of the state of New York are often used for contract law in foreign countries because it has such a big body of case law. And lawyers know what to expect. But in the state of New York, you have an issue with the courts. You have an issue with the ruling of the judge or the way they handle procedure. You can file an Article 78 hearing and basically take that judge to court on 24 hours notice and make them prove that their actions meet due process. And this is a very powerful tool that most citizens don't realize they have. And rarely will a lawyer do that to a judge because they know they'll appear in front of that judge 100 times in the course of their career. But there's nothing to stop a pro se litigant from doing it. This is why the courts don't like pro se litigants. It's not that they don't like pro se litigants because they write terrible briefs, which occasionally they do. They don't like them because if a pro se litigant gets an understanding of the system, they can use the system to drive through a case and get a ruling on the point of law that they really want. And the rise of, say, litigants in the United States has been exponential in the past 10 years. I think once 9/11 happened, you started to see it more and more and more. And perhaps it's just also a function of the fact that people are too broke to hire a lawyer.
Well, yeah, I think that strikes a little bit more closely to the heart of the reality of the matter, because unfortunately it strikes me that the court system itself is a type of game that's been set up, and obviously there are different tools in the toolbox there that people who are pro se and who do understand the system can use, but really, who has the time to study the system to that extent and to know what tools they have at their disposal? And it seems to me like the cards are definitely stacked in the favor of the court system and the lawyers and judges who you say are in cahoots and who do really have control over the system itself. So, I mean, it really does seem like it's just something that's a type of game that's stacked against us. And that's why I think movements like the Occupy Wall Street are at least potentially hopeful, because it strikes me that it's trying to circumvent all of the shenanigans, the legal shenanigans that are pulled in the court system and trying to implement something more directly.
Well, interestingly, I'm doing my best to try and pass on what little knowledge I have of the New York court system to the people that are most active in Occupy Wall Street. There's a lot of points of law that most people don't realize, relate to an arrest. And everybody knows they're supposed to be read their rights. There's a lot of things that are commonly known, and the police always abide by those because they know these are traps that will get a case thrown out. What most people don't realize is when a policeman takes you into custody, there's a basic choice he makes on the spot, and he has to be able to justify this choice. Is this person a clear and present danger to me now? And if the answer is no, then the policeman's next action is not to jail the person. He can jail if he sees you as a let's say you're crazy and you assault three policemen, and it ends up being a rumble for them to put you in cuffs, and it's obvious that this person is not going to be you're not going to be able to control this person unless you somehow imprison him. In that case, he could take you to jail. But in every other case, the law says the first action is to take you in front of a magistrate for an arraignment to see if there is a charge. Because the policeman doesn't decide if there's a charge. The magistrate, court, a judge of some form, whether it be at a town court or, you know, a county court or the Supreme Court, has to make a brief ruling that there's a charge to be brought against this person. And at that point, a judgment is made whether you're issued bail and given your freedom or whether you're put in jail. And, for example, in the protests, they round everybody up and they haul them off to jail. Well, when they do that, they are, in essence, committing kidnapping. They have crossed the line. They're not obeying the due process of law. And the protesters can charge the individual policeman with armed kidnapping because they're displaying a weapon while they do it. They can file individual criminal charges against the police officers involved. And there's nothing that can stop the protesters from doing it. And the police have a real problem on their hand because the protester would send them to the district attorney and send them to a judge. Now, in American law, if you're aware of a crime and you do not take action to report it, or to see that it's dealt with properly under the law, you've committed a new crime. You're shielding someone from prosecution. So this district attorney who gets these charges, or this judge, finds himself in the unappetizing position where they have criminal charges against police officers that are very hard to get rid of. Now, I think the argument can easily be made that these things will eventually disappear or will not be acted upon. But in the meantime, they have a political hot potato. And if there's anything that protesting is about, it's about politics. It's about putting people on the spot. And if these protesters would charge the police officers that imprison them rather than arraign them, they would find themselves in a situation where the police would be much more polite and friendly and a lot less aggressive going forward, because no cop wants a criminal charge in his dossier.
Well, I have no doubt that what you say is technically correct. Can you cite a single example in recent history of one of these mass roundups where a police officer has been successfully prosecuted for engaging in this activity?
No, I can't. But again, my central point is not that the charges come to trial and that the person is somehow stripped of their badge, although in cases where police have acted brutally and have crossed the line and there's public proof of it, this has happened. What I'm arguing is the political pressure that this brings to bear is really the way to game the system. It's using the system that they are in control of against them. Because if you send a judge 25, you list 25 police officers and you charge them all with armed kidnapping, that judge has to decide what to do with those charges. If he does not act on those charges in some way, then you go ahead and you file a shielding from prosecution charge against him with a higher court. Now, that judge runs for office, as does the district attorney in most counties. And their political opponents will make hay with that. The protesters need to understand that the system has to, like most systems, and certainly systems of tyrants and oppressors, have to maintain the appearance of being some kind of legitimate system and playing by the rules. This is why tyrants are always very sensitive when someone says, oh, you've done something wrong to me. They do their best to hide this because it's really public opinion that keeps them in their position. And this is, I believe, their Achilles heel when it comes to dealing with protests. Certainly, you could argue that the actions of litigants against police officers and the military in the United States has evolved. You know, if you go back to the turn of the 19th to 20th century, the police would, you know, open fire on union workers, or, you know, drop bombs from airplanes on miners who were on strike, and they got away with it. But in those actions, people fought back through the court system, and the political embarrassment attached to that started to change things. Now police realize that they're constantly being watched, they're being filmed, and they realize that who wins or loses in these conflicts is really a political question. It's really a public relations question. And that's what I think is the most frightening to the establishment in Wall Street, is the fact that they have a public relations nightmare on their hands right now. And it doesn't look like it's going to go away. I'm certain it's not going to go away. If they succeed in suppressing and breaking up the Occupy Wall Street movement, it will crop up. It will pop up somewhere else very quickly.
Well, I think we are on the verge of some sort of transformative movement. And again, it's always a question of whether it's an educated and informed and responsible movement, or whether it's going to be co-opted and shunted off into false solutions. So I think this is a very interesting time at any rate. And turning our gaze forward for a moment, I understand that you're going to be attending some of the upcoming rallies. So, of course, none of us have a crystal ball, but what do you expect to see happening in the next coming days and weeks? And really, where do you hope that this movement is going?
Well, I'm going down in the morning tomorrow to see, you know, what's happening on the ground, and I'll try and attend as much as I can in the coming weeks. I think that what's become obvious to anybody involved in it here in the United States is the fact that already it's spreading. There's protest movements in Austin, in Denver, in San Francisco, and Seattle. These are the logical places where people have protested in the past, whether they protested, you know, the G20 in Seattle or Vancouver, I'm sorry. These are places that are hotbeds for protests already. But immediately, people have risen up to join in. And like any social movement, you know, in the 1960s in the United States, it started out with a very small and vocal group of people that started to gather followers, and as soon as they were oppressed publicly, came the reason to get share of the whole youth, and that's what's happening here. I think that the unemployment rate for people under 30 is 50% in the United States. These people have no way to make a livelihood, to make a living for themselves, to have a life, to have a home and a family. And they know it, and they're unhappy about it, and they've been looking for an outlet. I think going forward, the real danger lies in it being co-opted, it being managed. This is where the fact that this is a leaderless movement is a great advantage. I think that in the short term, the establishment will attempt to put plants in to essentially lead the, you know, be the Pied Piper and lead this movement off into obscurity or into issues that are really not central to what's going on. I think that's the greatest danger. I guess, you know, it remains to be seen, but the month of October, both in the stock market, which is in chaos and seemingly about to fall, and on the ground in the United States is going to be the critical month, I think, between now and Halloween and November 5th, which is Guy Fawkes Day in England. There's going to be a real test to see if they don't break it by then. I think that the movement is going to explode and will start to command the events in the United States. I think the authorities seem to be a little bit behind the curve on this one, which is odd considering how much preparation they seem to have put into watching us and waiting for dissent.
Well, that's exactly right. I would say almost suspiciously behind the curve in some ways, and we've seen some
agree.
Yeah, we've seen some indications that, of course, these protests are being fomented by some of the very insiders who are actually trying to direct protest in a certain direction and basically get people to start demanding the things that Wall Street has already more or less wanted for themselves, with Buffett coming out and demanding more taxes for and things like that. I think there's some interesting ways that this could develop. But as I say, it's still in its early stages, and there's a lot of different ways that we can help to push this in directions that do matter by inserting ourselves into that mix. So I very much appreciate the conversation and the observations. And I think that the little bit of philosophical reflection about common law is very important at this time, because we have to ground ourselves in history. So again, a very fascinating conversation. So I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us, and hopefully we can get some more reports in the future if you're up for it.
I'd love to do it. Thanks for having me on.